This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Ferry. Welcome to another rebroadcast from the RTB Archives.
Take the shot, count it down, zip it off. Hey, meet the swinger, over right swinger.
Photography as a hobby can lead to photography as a career, and often does. But professional work calls for a lot more than just snapping pictures here and there.
Hello, and welcome to Recall This Book Presents, a brand new experiment, a very special Recall This Book. As you know, our usual format is to center discussion around books from the past that help us to make sense of contemporary problems. But today we have invited a colleague to come in and present rather than a dusty old book. Q Foley man throwing dusty old book across room. Instead, his brand new podcast. We will hear from the creator himself, hear some tempting highlights from the show, and discuss the ways in which he's approached making a podcast, perhaps even compare them to our own scintillating method of plying our friends with coffee and then locking them in the studio with us. So in our lockbox today, as usual, we have the great escape artist and anthropologist, Elizabeth Ferry. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hello.
And me, John Plotz, and to our great delight, Professor Jared Green of the Stonehill College English Department. Hey, Jared.
Hello.
Hello. So, Jared, you started your career as a modernist with articles on Faulkner and that ilk, but in recent years you've worked on documentary cinema, on hip-hop, and you also have screenplays and theatrical credits, which are very exciting. So that's an amazing resume, and it clearly prepares you to undertake this creative sort of podcast, which we are happy to present, The Electro Library. So it's great to have you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay.
Pleasure to be locked in here.
Yeah, well, we enjoy it.
And
yeah,
thanks for playing the Swinger as my theme song.
You'll always be a swinger to me, Jared. So we're going to be hearing a couple of substantial pieces out of your recent episode on photography.
Great.
I should say one of your two recent episodes on photography. But can you just kick things off for us by talking about the genesis of the podcast, by which I mean a couple of things, like in whose eye was it a gleam, and also what happened to that gleam in the months or years before your actual first episode on storytelling dropped in December 2017. And I'd like to request that you use words like dropped a lot in our conversation.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Because,
yeah. As is the parlance of podcasting. Well, first, I'd like to make clear that this is not solely my production or my creation. So I work with Professors Amber Brooks and Scott Cohen at Stonehill. And this emerged out of multiple gleams and multiple eyes. So
Okay. It
is something that I wanted to do for a while. I didn't really have any of the equipment. I didn't really have a very clear sense of what the show would be. But Scott, in particular, as we at Stonehill were building the Digital Innovation Lab, was also thinking about constructing a podcasting studio, just trying to bring a lot of different forms of digital expression into that space. And so I realized we might have an opportunity. And Amra was also thinking about doing something with her creative writing students. And things sort of lay fallow for a little bit with a lot of intention and desire to make something happen, but no clear ideas. And then I got to thinking, actually, I was inspired by Lewis Lapham's Quarterly, and I was thinking that that could be an interesting format for a show, is to go at a theme from many different historical periods, different perspectives, cultural perspectives, and different genres as well. And so I kind of proposed that to Scott, and we wound up joining forces to think of doing this kind of magazine or anthology show.
Maybe with that in mind, we can just listen to the first 3 minutes of the episode, what's called Photography Part 1. Literally, this is the beginning that you will hear when you go to listen to all the episodes of Electro Library. This is how Photography Part 1 of Electro Library actually starts, and we'll be back to discuss it in 3 minutes.
Photography is often called the universal hobby. It is a means of creative expression within the reach of people in all walks of life, and it speaks a language that everyone can understand.
What happens when we take a photograph? What happens when we capture light on paper, in emulsion, or in pixels and look across a gulf of time at these fragments of the past? What gets in the frame and what lies just beyond it? If, as John Berger notes, photographs bear witness to a human choice being exercised in a certain situation, then what can photographs tell us about the choices we make and why we make them? From the Stonehill College English Department, in conjunction with the Digital Humanities and Creative Writing Programs, it's the Electro Library. A podcast, a literary neural network, a philosophical space-time remix, a kaleidoscope of consciousness on electromagnetic waves. Each episode explores a single theme across time, cultures, and disciplines. The Electro Library, a cabinet of curiosities for your ears. Episode 3, Photography.
The camera lens is a mechanical eye, seeing everything and recording everything. It captures actions that will never again be repeated.
People were stunned when they heard the two inventors had perfected a process that could capture an image on a silver plate. It is impossible for us to imagine today the universal confusion that greeted this invention. So accustomed have we become to the fact of photography, and so inured are we by now to its vulgarization. But not so then. There were some who, like stubborn cattle, refused to even believe that it was possible. What an obstinate race of ill-tempered beings we are, resistant by nature to anything that ruffles our ideas or interferes with our habits.
Maybe that's a good time to talk about the fact that you chose to make this podcast about photography. So
there's definitely a certain perversity to it, but there's actually something I really loved about that idea of working with images in a way that had to be described if you were to see anything. And that was suggested to me actually by some things that I teach in a class on photo and literature that render verbal descriptions of visual material and sometimes don't actually show the material. So I'm thinking about something. I first got to thinking about this from reading Marguerite Duras's The Lover, in which she describes a photograph never taken on her crossing of the Mekong Delta. And it's a moment where she recognizes she's crossing over into kind of young adulthood and into sexual realization and seeing herself. But there's no photograph because no one would have thought it was a moment to photograph. And I've been really fascinated by that idea. And I started looking for other moments in literature where there are verbal descriptions of photographs that are not embedded, so you don't actually see the photograph,
right?
Or maybe didn't exist at all.
Yeah.
And by the time we were making this podcast, I thought, I think that would be perfect. Let's work with these images, but that we can't actually see. We can only see through however we generate that material auditorially.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So I want to play in a minute. This is the longest chunk we're going to play. It's a Umberto Eco essay, and I'm going to ask you to introduce it for us. But also, one thing that I really noticed that makes the essay work really effectively, I think, is the way that you guys use background music. So can you talk a little bit about your decision on, like, what do they call it, the acoustic environment?
Yeah. So this is a really good example of the collaboration that goes into this piece. So This was really driven by Scott Cohen's desire to do the echo piece. He's taught this in the past, at least. I don't know if he's taught it recently. And he wanted to bring that to the show. It's a piece that he especially loves. And he actually found the archival sound, which is very hard to find, of the closing down of Radio Alice. This is something he managed to find, I think, possibly using the Wayback Machine. It's stored on some Web 1.0 site. So.
And we're just going to hear a tiny snippet of it. It's going to be very hard for you to place, but that's what
so
it
he,
is.
Yeah. So he already began that kind of ability to experience the moment that Echo is experiencing, bring that into our podcast. And then when he had recorded his piece with that archival sound, he sent it to me, and I was thinking about what kind of music would feel right for the overall environment that we're building and for the experience we want to offer and for the ideas. So here it was something that was kind of abstract electronic washes that felt slightly menacing, like there's a degree of drama to it, but also at the same time, to me, almost felt like an auditory equivalent of experiencing the past and the present coming together.
Yeah.
And that sounds very overthought, but when I heard the piece, I was looking through a lot of different music, trying to hear it as it would go with the echo piece. That's what struck me.
You know, that's such a helpful comment, Jared, because it reminds me of something I meant to say, but I didn't write it down, so then I forgot it, which is that, you know, I've read really interesting articles about the golden age of radio and the golden age of TV that have made the point that in many ways, it's really helpful to think about TV serials as fundamentally radio serials. Like, in other words, rather than thinking of the lineage from film, which is how we normally think about it, like it's visual packed into a small box, think about the TV as like an expanded version of the radio. So fundamentally, the acoustic environment. You know, people often talk about watching the TV when they're in the other room. And I do this. When Lisa and I watch, like, you know, trashy spy thrillers, which we do a lot, frequently I'm not watching the screen. I'm just listening. And the mood music in, like, you know, Counterpart will tell me when I need to turn back.
And also it's like it's scaled for the living room, right?
Yeah.
So it has this kind of domestic...
Domestic
scale that film didn't.
Exactly.
Many of the early TV programs had been radio programs.
Yeah.
So they're literally drifting from one medium to another.
Yeah.
I mean, it's probably not right to say that it's radio with pictures, but it's the same industrial production model.
Yeah.
It's the same commercial production model.
Yeah.
And they're often using the same actors and the same writers, and some of those are the same programs. The Lone Ranger would be one example of many.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's...
And I think you could even make that case about TV news as well, where, like, liveness is the thing that radio and TV have in common, which film, by definition, doesn't have. So that, like, the talking head giving you the news, like, that could be, you know, the Hindenburg is a radio broadcast, but we remember that so vividly. You know?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and also that, you know, that choice of the TV news model of the desk and the sort of people facing the camera is just one kind of a choice from how radio might look.
Yeah, totally. Okay, so let us play a long piece, which is an Umberto Eco essay, which has now been kind of curated and scored and presented by Electro Library. And it makes an argument about how you think about photography in its role within politics. It basically makes the case that a photograph can make an argument.
Sono porco di aprite e cose di questo genere. Alice?
A photograph by Umberto Eco. The readers of L'Espresso will recall the tape of the last minutes of Radio Alice, recorded as the police were hammering at the door. One thing that impressed many people was how the announcer, as he reported in a tense voice what was happening, tried to convey the situation by referring to a scene in a movie. There was undoubtedly something singular about an individual going through a fairly traumatic experience as if he were in a film. There can be only two interpretations. One is the traditional. Life is lived as a work of art. The other obliges us to reflect a bit further. It is the visual work, cinema, videotape, mural, comic strip, photograph, that is now part of our memory, which is quite different and seems to confirm a hypothesis already ventured, namely that the younger generations have absorbed as elements of their behavior a series of elements filtered through the mass media. To tell the truth, it isn't even necessary to talk about new generations. If you're barely middle-aged, you will have learned personally the extent to which experience, love, fear, or hope is filtered through already seen images. I leave it to the moralists to deplore this way of living by intermediate communication. We must only bear in mind that mankind has never done anything else. And before the technology of photography, it was other images drawn from pagan carvings or illuminated manuscripts of the apocalypse. And now to another event. These last months, within that variegated and shifting experience that is called the movement, the men carrying 38 caliber pistols have emerged. From various quarters, the movement has been asked to denounce them as an alien body. Apparently, this demand for rejection encountered difficulties, and various elements came into play. Synthetically, we can say that many belonging to the movement didn't feel like labeling as outsiders forces that, even if they revealed themselves in unacceptable and tragically suicidal ways, seemed to express a reality of social protest that could not be denied. Basically, what was said was this: they are wrong, but they are part of a mass movement. And the debate was harsh, painful. Now, last week there occurred a kind of precipitation of all the elements of the debate previously suspended in uncertainty. Suddenly, and I say suddenly because decisive statements were issued in the space of a day, the gunmen were cut off. Why at that moment? Why not before? It's not enough to say that the violent riots in Milan made a deep impression on many people, because similar events in Rome had also a profound effect. What happened that was new and different? We may venture a hypothesis, once again recalling that an explanation never explains everything, but becomes part of a landscape of explanations in reciprocal relationship. A photograph appeared. Many photographs have appeared, but this one made the rounds of all the papers. It was the photograph of a young man wearing a knitted ski mask, standing alone, in profile, in the middle of a street, legs apart, arms outstretched horizontally, with both hands grasping a pistol. Other forms can be seen in the background, but the photograph's structure is classical in its simplicity. The central figure, isolated, dominates it. If it is licit, and it is necessary, to make aesthetic observations in such cases, this is one of those photographs that will go down in history and will appear in 1,000 books. The vicissitudes of our century have been summed up in a few exemplary photographs that have proved epoch-making. The unruly crowd pouring into the square during the 10 days that shook the world, Robert Capa's dying miliciano, the Marines planting the flag on Iwo Jima, the Vietnamese prisoner being executed with a shot in the temple, Che Guevara's tortured body on a plank in a barracks. Each of these images has become a myth and condensed numerous speeches. It has surpassed the individual circumstances that produced it. It no longer speaks to that single character or those characters, but expresses concepts. It is unique, but at the same time, it refers to other images that preceded it or that in imitation have followed it. Each of these photographs seems a film we have seen and refers to other films that had seen it. Sometimes it isn't a photograph, but a painting or a poster. What did the photograph of the Milanese gunman say? I believe it abruptly revealed, without the need for a lot of digressive speeches, something that had been circulating in a lot of talk, but that words alone could not.
To me, I love that turn at the end where it makes the case that this is, you know, the photograph as argument.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I do think it goes back to the point that, I mean, in a way, it relates to the Cabinet of Curiosities point, because it has to do with whether we think of artwork as having this long durée existence where it's always around and we can bring it up mm-hmm. and show it to people. Like, we discovered this marvelous piece of sound from Radio Alice. We can bring it back to you. Or we think about artwork in that moment of, you know, vivid presentness where mm-hmm. all of a sudden people saw this photograph and boom, it changed their thinking.
Right. One thing that's interesting, and maybe there are listeners out there who would correct me on this, but I think the thing that Echo gets wrong in a predictive way is I don't believe that this image of the Milanese gunman actually did enter into a broader way of thinking about images that have shaped consciousness. In some way, it really resides in Echo's account. Mm-hmm. Right? So he sees on something absolutely at that moment, galvanized opinion, gave a human face to a thing that was on a scale that was beyond imagination and suddenly made it look like insanity, right? This was chaos. This was not heroic.
Right.
And so that did shift that conversation. But he says this is going to enter into a future history of very significant images. And he thinks about the Kappa image, right? Or the image of the execution in Vietnam and so forth. Mm-hmm. And to the best of my knowledge, it actually has dropped out of that conversation and exists only in Echo's framing of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it seems like there's two thoughts that come out of that. One is whether it matters. Like, first of all, it's always the nature. If you're writing about the present, you're always going to be wrong more often than you're right. Yeah. Like, it's easy. I mean, I talk about this with my friends who teach contemporary literature all the time, because it's easy for me to pick a bunch of, you know, Thomas Hardy and George Eliot novels to teach. And my, you know, my friends who teach contemporary literature have to struggle with, like, well, which of the Pulitzer Prize winners should I do? But then the other point that I think you're making, Jared, is implicitly that like he's displacing his own cultural influence. Like, he's saying the influence is in the photograph, but actually it's more like his publishing. Pulitzer, presumably that was a well-circulated essay at the time.
Yes, and then appears in Travels in Hyperreality in the early 80s, 82, 84. I can't quite remember when that came out. But I think and the reason that Scott wanted to bring this to the show is not so much because of the significance of that image, but because Echo, who's doing an early shot across the bow of a postmodern account of the image, there's a tradition he's working in from Benjamin and Barthes, but at the same time, this is fairly early on in terms of thinking about what a media-saturated environment really does in terms of shaping political consciousness. That still feels very relevant, and I think Scott was right to identify. It feels as though if we just inserted some different reference points, we might be talking about the Gilets Jaunes, and representations of, say, the refugee crisis or Antifa, right? Something like that. The ways in which the political becomes visualizable and therefore imaginable, and then arguments can get made about it because it circulates on a figure of a human doing a thing.
Okay, so this brings me to, I think, one of the main reasons that I wanted to talk about the photographic podcast, which is the question of where we understand the moment of, like, acoustic new media versus visual new media. Because, Jared, the thing you're setting up now there with those, striking, iconic, visually argumentative things that flood the visual public sphere might lend itself to an implicit counterargument, which we've read in, like, the pages of the New York Times about, like, no, but newsprint is the alternative to that. It provides, like, a sober, deliberative space.
Right.
Or you could even imagine, and this is, like, my favorite way to think about this is by way of in Frankenstein, when Frankenstein's monster tells his story, it's only the blind man that can hear him and not freak out, because he's so visually horrific that people have a somatic reaction to his visual appearance. But when they just listen to his words, that is when they listen to the podcast version of Frankenstein's monster, which we should do, by the way. We should totally do the Frankenstein's monster podcast. Hello. I am a sad monster. But, you know, that point is that the acoustic
fire in the booth.
Yeah. the acoustic version is meant to be, you know, just like kind of innately more moderate. So that's one way of setting this up, where visual is bad, but visual is on one side of the spectrum and then the acoustic is kind of on the other. Is that where we want to land, or do we want to land more on
that is not bad, but sort of one is more honest or authentic?
Yeah, like the acoustic provides a space for deliberation or a space for truth or something, whereas the visual is just telling stories that, like snap your synapses.
Unreliable.
Yeah, they trigger, like Aristotle talks about sensation as being one of the dimensions of the aesthetic experience, and that the visual triggers sensation.
Mm-hmm. Interesting that you're saying the visual triggers somatic sensations.
Yeah.
So there's...
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, no, but...
aesthetic kind of.
Yeah. No, that's true, right? Because historically, sometimes people have said that of the senses, the visual is more distant, whereas something like touch is more immediate.
More rational or whatever.
Totally, that's true. But just to keep the other side, the other way of thinking about this in play would be that whatever media form is new is the form that really grabs people. By which logic, you know, the podcast could also be like that. So how do we think about those things? Do we believe there is something more charged about the visual and more safe about the acoustic? Or?
Why are you doing this book as a podcast as opposed to, say, a video blog? What attracts you?
I don't know how to use a video camera.
All right. Okay, that's
because I have face for radio. Not Elizabeth Ferry has a face for YouTube, but I have a face for radio. So.
But is it? I mean, it surely can't be the case that that's the only reason that you felt this was the medium that was right for having the kind of discussion you wanted to have.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things is where, going back to the Cavern of Curiosities logic of your podcast, I mean, ours kind of follows the logic of the conversation, right?
Yeah.
So, and that, you know, clearly in conversations there is, you know, plenty of senses that might get engaged, but it's,
yeah,
you know, the vocal is pretty primary.
Totally. Yeah, like, it's very important to us to do the conversations live. Like, we like being face to face with one another. We have not liked it when we've tried doing it remotely. We didn't like that. So we do like sharing a space with one another. But
And also the conversation, there's lots of, obviously there's choices that go into setting it up in the first place, but a lot of the choices also emerge through the conversation. We don't necessarily know exactly how it's going to go.
Right.
So I think that lends itself to the auditory.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Well, a conversation is very different in terms of the energy of its directions than a much more kind of controlled, we're going to have this sound at this moment, and we'll cut out that piece that we didn't like. And right, so our shaping of an auditory experience is a kind of different experience that we offer. Because you're mentioning the sensory registers of the auditory. And I just think back to a time when my daughter Zoe was listening to Let's Pretend, because I was thinking, oh, I love this. I'm going to play these for her. And we would, on our drive to school, we would play this. And she did
amazing
love
how
them.
We tyrannize over our children.
Yes, well, right, exactly, curating their experiences.
Yes. Yeah.
But I discovered, actually, that some of them were too intense because they were auditory only. Because what they did was to trigger images that were entirely in her mind.
Yeah.
So there was no distance she could get from them. They were in her brain.
Yeah.
And I realized that this medium has power that others don't, or that is different.
Yeah.
Right. So the ways that we experience visual material when it's produced only by sound is a different set of probably neuroelectric reactions even.
Yeah. So that actually relates to a conversation that we were having earlier, kind of somewhat off mic, about the ways in which when you listen to podcasts, you tend not to look at the people you're in the room with. And the thing I wanted to connect that to is that, like, so my experience of podcast is like when biking or when driving.
Right.
And in certain ways, that is a form of blindness because, of course, you're looking when you drive. I'm not an idiot, but you're looking at something other than the story.
Right, definitely.
But so I guess what I'm saying is, like, in a way, maybe the ideal podcast audience is a blind audience in that broader sense of what blindness means there, like the blind man in Frankenstein just being capable of focusing on the ear.
Yeah.
But taking into account, Jared, what you're saying, that that's actually kind of, there's an overload version of that, too.
Right.
Like, it can be too vivid.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Can I ask you, literature dudes, about the term ekphrasis?
Yes.
Which is, as I remember, writing a piece about something that is in some other medium, especially like a painting. Or,
yeah, I think I think ekphrasis can actually describe any kind of translation, can't it, from one
certainly
medium
at this point,
to another?
A modern understanding of ekphrasis, absolutely. It begins with a poetic description of visual material,
right.
but it gets much broader. And so, right. Absolutely.
So your episode then could be seen as an ekphrastic project.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's an ekphrastic project on ekphrastic projects.
Right.
It's kind of a hall of mirrors.
Yeah.
So speaking of which, Jared, I definitely want to hear about where you guys are heading with this. But before we do, that just leads me to, I'm still thinking about like the form of compare and contrast between the sort of beautifully curated acoustical space you do and the kind of flabby conversation that we do. Can I ask you guys a question? No, I don't need your pity. It's okay. I like my flabby conversation. I'm 51, man. I have to like flabby. Come on.
Not completely knowing what we're talking
about. But
or
the question is
myself,
this. I just recently read two John le Carré novels, and one of which was the traditional audiobook where somebody just read the whole novel through, and the other was a staged drama version of the episodes. So with people playing the voices. So my question is, do you guys have a preference between those two things? Because I just vastly preferred hearing someone read the whole book. Like, that was my preference. I wanted to hear the book and have it drop into my head.
Right.
But I understand why you would want to do it as a radio play. I get the appeal of that. Mm-hmm. So do you guys have a feeling about that? It had Foley men, like great Foley men, like doors creaked open.
I mean, I feel like I'm so unaccustomed to listening to radio plays that they feel, I don't think I can really get the juice out of them because they feel so strange and stagey to me. Whereas, you know, there's nothing intrinsically less stagey about reading a book into a microphone, but somehow I'm able to experience that more as a more natural medium. But that may just be me.
I guess I would say, and this is perhaps a bit evasive, it really depends on the experience I'm looking to have. If I want to hear a political conversation, I want it direct and live, and I want to hear ideas unfold, and I don't want to have the sense that it's artificial, which would take me out of that moment and make me feel that it's inauthentic, and that's not what I was seeking. But I can certainly imagine a very well done production. It would have to be the acting would have to be good and the sound has to be good. Right?
Yeah.
So imagining a very high level production, if I'm seeking an experience of world building where I want more more senses activated, then that's something that I might seek out.
Right.
So I'm not necessarily going to come down on one side or another.
No, it makes sense.
It really
I think your
very,
podcast builds a world, and I don't think ours does. And I do think that's a difference.
Well, yours builds the world of the sharing of social energy through conversation. So it's a different kind of world.
Well, we invite you to imagine being part of that conversation, but it is different from building. It's not a Gesamtkunstwerk. I mean, you're more Wagnerian. We're more
I don't know how to take that.
We're more like Schubert leader off on the edge.
So I have a question that just occurred to me. So occasionally my kids every year they have to read a book for the next year of school, right? And it mostly sucks. Most of them are not very good, I find.
Hat tip to the Brooklyn Public Schools, yes.
and I always find myself in this sort of quandary because, you know, I buy the book and then I try to get them to read the book and, you know, they're readers. They read things. But often it's kind of a struggle to get them to read this particular book and I don't feel very invested in it often. But I feel this like it's cheating to get the book on the audio book. So why do I feel like it's cheating? That's my question. Or maybe it is cheating. Or maybe, I don't know. I mean, hearing it and
They're taking in content, which is different from absorbing, digesting, and thinking about that content. It's not to say that you can't do that.
But the argument is that you wouldn't be. It's not just content, right? Because you still have to decipher the syntax of a sentence that someone reads.
Sure.
I mean, you know, it's certainly, we've all had the experience of our passing our eyes over a page in a reading-like,
very true.
Without.
Yeah.
But what you can't do, or it would require a different way of listening to an audiobook, is something that is one of the principal pleasures of reading, which is to move away from that page and that imaginary world into whatever it's making you think. Because if you do that while listening to an audiobook, you will miss content. You will miss the next set of sentences.
Isn't that sort of the opposite of what you just said about your daughter and the you know, being more afraid about let's pretend because well, those are into her.
Well, those are role. Those are stage
no because he's
performances.
Saying it's a command performance also.
Right.
Like he's saying that you can't stop the drone of the words. So, but I have two thoughts
you
about
could,
that.
Though.
You could, yeah. First of all, technologically, yeah. You can, and I think
I guess
our children are really good at like hitting the pause
right.
button.
What,
but
what I'm trying to underline is the difference between, I think, attention
yeah.
and what we do with that attention, and the medium by which we absorb
yeah.
the information.
I was actually thinking we should do a podcast experiment, which would be so fun, which would be to have one person in here like reading out an essay or a story or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and the other people should just interrupt with whatever thoughts come into their heads. Like, in other words, we should try to document that thing that Roland Barthes says in The Pleasure of the Text, which is that the reader's power is to choose when to skip or when to daydream,
right.
but we should record it in real time. So
yes.
it would be like those, you know, Snoopy's train of consciousness.
Or MST3K, you know what? That is it's like the MST3K of the
right.
reading, right? Right?
Is that Mystery Science Theater
yeah.
3000?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
okay.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Okay. I had to write it down and look at
is
it in my mind.
Or is that only my
Mystery
brain?
Science Theater
yeah.
3000 is MST3K.
See? Yeah.
Wow.
See now if you
R2-D2.
You know, listen to more books on tape, you would have
A-B.
Picked up on that one.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Okay.
I didn't see that being the major educational moment of this conversation.
I really like the idea of stream of consciousness reading.
Yeah,
I would love you to know, Elizabeth, what's going on in my head as you as you read your favorite what would you read? What would you pick?
For?
Like if you read out your favorite short story or something. I think I might pick like a
with commentary with
yeah,
my own.
Yeah.
Come back to me on that.
Yeah.
Jared, which would you read?
Yeah.
I don't carry an answer to this question around in my head all the time,
yeah.
but...
I think for me it might be like Robert Frost poems or something like that. I don't know.
Uh-huh.
Like
I was thinking P.G. Wodehouse, The Great Story.
Oh, yeah. Well, that...
That might just be my favorite story.
No, but so. That would be... that. I think people wouldn't daydream while they were listening to that because that's so arresting.
Right.
I think you're right. I mean, that's a great choice, but I don't think people's mind would wander while they were listening.
Right.
Yeah.
I might do something from Dubliners.
Oh, yeah. Well, that would be perfect
yeah.
because those
like the dead.
Like the dead.
Yeah, those James
dead,
Joyce
yeah.
stories definitely kick you off into
right.
a different
yeah.
register.
Especially with the dead is the one yeah. that has this image of the snow.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right? So that also kind of brings you into
yeah.
a visual register where you would be.
Okay.
And a Foley artist for its tapping against the head.
Okay.
Yeah.
So a podcast of listening. Listening
but
as podcast.
I feel like. Just so not to lose this thread, that there's
yeah.
something that we're circulating around, which is actually a very kind of Frankfurt School question. We're almost right in the zone of critique that Horkheimer and Adorno were in the culture industry about what kinds of mediums are monodirectional and
right.
which ones are reciprocal.
Yeah.
And even though we can hit the pause button on
yeah.
this podcast or on any kind of audio
yeah.
medium, they aren't really reciprocal.
Yeah.
In
right.
the way that, for instance, reading a book is in a sense. Now, we can't reach to the author and say, don't say
right.
that. But we can stop on the page. We can mark the page. We can close that mm-hmm. book. We can think differently. We can resist what's being said.
But, you know,
said,
when I listen to a book on tape.
We can have a different degree of engagement with it.
It's a
yeah.
different
yeah.
kind of engagement. And when you were saying, John, like this is training, that's kind of the issue. What do our expressive mediums train all of us, not just kids, obviously,
yeah.
to expect from a certain mode of address? What kind of attention do we pay when an authoritative voice is coming out over the radio?
So I totally hear what you're saying, but I feel like there is, you know, when you read the Jeremiads against like how modern day media are destroying thought, which,
right.
by the way, had been
yeah.
published from like 1150
yeah.
AD
exactly.
to the present.
Right.
Like
you
the
know,
Jeremiads,
Plato hated writing.
Right. So the Jeremiads sometimes run along the lines of the problem with the new media is that they don't allow any space for thought. But with the contemporary media,
right.
I've also heard the other Jeremiad, it's too easy for people
right.
to produce content now.
Right.
So you can't really have it both ways.
Right.
Like either it's suppressive of content or it's generative
well,
of content.
Like the,
but it
you know,
can't be. You can't condemn it for
yeah,
both.
Yeah, I mean, they used to say that, you know, computers made people too antisocial. And now it's like.
Right. It makes
you
too social.
Too social.
Right.
Right.
Right. Because all the bullying is cyberbullying.
Right.
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 Yeah. That's a really good point.
But I kind of feel like these arguments have always been true. Both
yeah.
sides of that argument
right.
have always been true.
Right.
Plato was absolutely right. Writing did destroy oral culture. except for what we're doing right now. It took millennia for it to come back.
Yeah. But here in our locked room, only one side is allowed to be right. Sorry. That's just in this room. In the world, yes. But in this room, only one side can be right.
There are only two possible interpretations.
Exactly. There are. I think Echo would have made a good podcast partner. Yeah. I'm sorry we couldn't interview
him. I think he would have loved this medium.
I definitely agree. So, Jared, this has been great. But as we move to wrapping up, tell us about next steps. Like, where are you guys heading?
Well, I think we'll try to keep refining our ability to create an interesting sound experience. The way the episodes have, I don't know if this is obvious from if you listen from the first one on, they develop from the prior episode. So we began with storytelling, which had a great deal necessarily to do with memory and cultural transmission. And so we did an episode on memory. Mm-hmm. And there were issues about photography that came up in the episode on memory. So we did the episode on photography. Mm-hmm. Coming out of this work on photography, this may seem a little more far afield, but I got to thinking about, because so much of the writing was about black and white photography, I got to think about color.
Mm-hmm.
That's a future episode. But from this set of
which
materials,
is even easier to do in a podcast than photography.
Well, I like a challenge. I do like a challenge. But the next episode will be about identity, which emerges directly from a lot of the things that we were encountering with this episode on photography. So what I like is a sort of fractal process that we keep. I don't know if it's drilling down or moving outward. Maybe it's
It sounds more like
both.
Brownian motion, but
good. I'll take it.
Random walks.
So I like the idea of episodes developing in that way, that something that we got interested in leads to the next set of questions and then, you know, leads us to ask people, how would you now address this issue? What would you bring to that conversation? So I think that's how it will continue to develop, because that feels the most organic and exciting, that, you know, something in an episode touches off the desire for the next one.
Yeah, cool.
And hopefully we'll have people listening so that we have a reason to keep going.
Well, I'm sure you will. It's a great show, and it will. If it doesn't yet have a great audience, I'm sure it will increase in due course.
It will now.
Yeah, of course. Yes.
Shall we switch to recallable books?
Let's do that. Let's switch. I just wanted to make sure there wasn't
fashion.
Was there. I didn't want to cut you off if you had another final question.
Yeah.
But so let's switch. Let's conclude as we always do with recallable books, which is a recommendation for further reading on the topic. Though I have to say today, since the topic is a podcast, I think we're going to have a much broader construal of the recallable. So it's like, let's call it the recallables, like the opposite of deplorables. So as with the books and podcasts we discussed today, there's going to be links to these on our website, along with other material for folks who want to explore the topic further. So for example, not only the photograph of the Milanese gunman, but also the Echo essay itself will be available. So Jared, can I ask you as our guest
Sure. I guess what I would recommend, maybe many of your listeners already know it, but it's such a touchstone of contemporary conversation about photography. I mean, it's embedded in the discourse of how people write about photography now, whether they're critiquing it or not. Would be Roland Barthes' Camera Lucida. I think that if your listeners don't know it, it is a magnificent book. It's beautiful. It's heartbreaking. He wrote it after the death of his mother, and a lot of it really has to do with, and we have a piece from that on our second part of the photography
episode. Yes, read by my friend Daniel
Itzkowitz. Read by Daniel Itzkowitz in his wonderful plummy basso.
plummy basso Itzkowitz, that's what they call him,
But that book is really magnificent, a way of introducing anybody to think about photography not just as what it delivers visually, but what kind of experiences it offers. And I can't recommend that highly enough.
Plus, it has great Mapplethorpe photographs in it.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Armpits.
Yes.
Remember the armpits.
Yeah.
Cool. That's great. And Elizabeth?
Yeah. So I'd like to recommend the work of Sarah Lewis, who's a professor at Harvard University. And I first learned about her work quite recently because of a New York Times Lens blog article about photographs and race, and sort of speaking of how photographs tell arguments. About how the kind of normal baseline of taking photographs became well, baked into is the wrong term, but sort of baked into film photography. And she talks about this thing that I had never known about called the Shirley card, which is this sort of, you know, baseline for measuring skin tone, which was, very fair-skinned white woman who was putatively named Shirley. And she also, in particular, I'd also like to recommend an edited issue by Lewis of the magazine Aperture from summer 2016 on vision and justice, which encapsulates a lot of these really fascinating issues about race and argument and photography.
That's great. I learned recently she is one of four professors at Harvard who's working on Frederick Douglass photographs right now. So it's clearly there's the movement afoot, which is great. And I'm going to recommend on the other sort of side of our discussion, I'm actually going to recommend a different podcast just because it has an acoustical environment that I really love. It's called The Habitat. It's, I think, a Gimlet show, and it follows, I want to say it's six. Yes, it's six people who lock themselves up in a Mars dome simulacrum on a mountain in Hawaii. And it's part of the training to figure out what it's eventually going to be like to live on Mars. But so it essentially allows us to have science fictional sound of people living inside a Mars dome where, you know, you get to hear them putting on their space suits in order to go out and do walks through the volcanic landscape that they're in. And it's just kind of a paradise of sonic environment and a total invitation to let's pretend, to imagining. I think it's a wonderful, it manages to be a sort of a factual world building exercise. I love it. I think that brings us to the close of our very, very special Recall This Book. Recall This Book is hosted by John Plotz and Elizabeth Ferry. Sound editing is by Claire Ogden. Web design and social media is done by Claire and Matthew Schratz. And future upcoming episodes include a conversation with the Chinese science fiction writer Xixian Liu, another with Zadie Smith, and one with the poet David Ferry and the biologist E.O. Wilson. So finally, if you enjoyed today's show, please be sure to tweet about us, mention the show on Facebook, or write a review and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast. And please do check out the Electro Library, really wonderful podcast. So thank you very much, Jared, and thanks to you all for listening.
Thank you both.